Golden Land. If he had been 30, he would not have needed the 2 aspirin tablets and the half glass of raw gin before he could bear the showers needling on his body and steady his hands to shave. But then, when he had been 30, neither could he have afforded to drink as much each evening as he now drank. Certainly he would not have done it in the company of the men and the women in which, at 48, he did each evening, even though knowing during the very final hours filled with the breaking of glass and the shrill cries of drunken women above the drums and saxophones, the hours during which he carried a little better than his weight both in the amount of liquor consumed and in the number and sum of checks paid, that 6 or 8 hours later he would rouse from what had not been sleep at all, but instead that dreamless stupefaction of alcohol out of which last night's turgid and licensed uproar would die, as though without any interval for rest or recuperation, into the familiar shape of his bedroom, the bed's foot silhouetted by the morning light which entered the bougainvillea-bound windows beyond which his painful and almost unbearable eyes could see the view which might be called the monument to almost 25 years of industry and desire, of shrewdness and luck and even fortitude, the opposite canyon flank dotted with the white villas half-hidden in imported olive groves or frieze by the somber-spaced columns of cypress, like the facades of eastern temples whose owners' names and faces and even voices were glib and familiar in back corners of the United States and of America and of the world where those of Einstein and Rousseau and Aesculapius had never sounded. He didn't waken sick. He never wakened ill, nor became ill from drinking, not only because he had drunk too long and too steadily for that, but because he was too tough even after the 30 soft years. He came from too tough stock on that day 34 years ago when at 14 he had fled, on the break beam of a westbound freight, the little lost Nebraska town named for, permeated with, his father's history and existence, a town to be sure, but only in the sense that any shadow is larger than the object which casts it. It was still frontier, even as he remembered it at 5 and 6, the projected and increased shadow of a small outpost of sod-roofed dugouts on the immense desolation of the plains where his father, Ira Ewing II, had been first to essay to wring wheat during the 6 days between those when, outdoors in spring and summer, and in the fetid half-dark of a snow-bound dugout in the winter and fall, he preached. The second Ira Ewing had come a long way since then, from that barren and treeless village which he had fled by a night freight to where he now lay in $100,000 house, waiting until he knew that he could rise and go to the bath and put the 2 aspirin tablets into his mouth. They, his mother and father, had tried to explain it to him, something about fortitude, the will to endure. At 14, he could neither answer them with logic and reason, nor explain what he wanted. He could only flee. Nor was he fleeing his father's harshness and wrath. He was fleeing the scene itself, the treeless immensity in the lost center of which he seemed to see the sum of his father's and mother's dead youth and bartered lives as a tiny forlorn spot which nature permitted to green into brief and niggard wheat for a season's moment before blotting it all with the primal and invincible snow, as though, not even promise, not even threat, in grim and almost playful augury of the final doom of all life. And it was not even this that he was fleeing, because he was not fleeing. It was only that absence, removal, was the only argument which 14 knew how to employ against adults with any hope of success. He spent the next 10 years half-tramp, half-casual laborer as he drifted down the Pacific coast to Los Angeles. At 30, He was married to a Los Angeles girl, daughter of a carpenter, and father of a son and a daughter, and with a foothold in real estate. At 48, he spent $50,000 a year owning a business which he had built up unaided and preserved intact through 1929. He had given to his children luxuries and advantages which his own father not only could not have conceived in fact, but would have condemned completely in theory, as it proved, as the paper which the Filipino chauffeur who each morning carried him into the house and undressed him and put him to bed had removed from the pocket of his topcoat and laid on the reading table, proved, with reason. On the death of his father 20 years ago, he had returned to Nebraska for the first time and fetched his mother back with him, and she was now established in a home of her own, only the less sumptuous, because she refused, with a kind of abashed and thoughtful unshakability which he did not remark, anything finer or more elaborate. It was the house in which they had all lived at first, though he and his wife and children had moved within the year. 3 years ago they had moved again, into the house where he now waked, in a select residential section of Beverly Hills, but not once in the 19 years had he failed to stop, not even during the last 5, when to move at all in the morning required a terrific drain on that character or strength which the elder Ira had bequeathed him, which had enabled the other Ira to pause on the Nebraska plain and dig a hole for his wife to bear children in while he planted wheat. On his way to the office, 20 miles out of his way to the office, and spend 10 minutes with her. She lived in as complete physical ease and peace as he could devise. He had arranged her affairs so that she did not even need to bother with money, cash, in order to live. He had arranged credit for her with a neighboring market and butcher, so that the Japanese gardener who came each day to water and tend the flowers could do her shopping for her. She never even saw the bills. And the only reason she had no servant was that even at 70, she apparently clung stubbornly to the old habit of doing her own cooking and housework. So it would seem that he had been right. Perhaps there were times when, lying in bed like this, and waiting for the will to rise and take the aspirin and the gin, mornings perhaps following evenings when he had drunk more than ordinarily, and when even the 6 or 7 hours of oblivion had not been sufficient to enable him to distinguish between reality and illusion, something of the old, strong, harsh Campbellite blood which the elder Ira must have bequeathed him might have caused him to see or feel or imagine his father looking down from somewhere upon him, the prodigal, and what he had accomplished. If this were so, then surely the elder Ira, looking down for the last 2 mornings upon the 2 tabloid papers which the Filipino removed from his master's topcoat and laid on the reading table, might have taken advantage of that old blood and taken his revenge, not just for that afternoon 34 years ago, but for the entire 34 years. When he gathered himself, his will, his body at last, and rose from the bed, he struck the paper so that it fell to the floor and lay open at his feet, but he did not look at it. He just stood so, tall in silk pajamas, thin where his father had been gaunt with the years of hard work and unceasing struggle with the unpredictable and implacable earth. Even now, despite the life which he had led, he had very little paunch, looking at nothing, while at his feet the black headline flared above the row of 5 or 6 tabloid photographs from which his daughter alternately stared back or flaunted long, pale shins. April Lalier Bears Orgy Secrets. When he moved at last, he stepped on the paper, walking on his bare feet into the bath. Now it was his trembling and jerking hands that he watched as he shook the 2 tablets onto the glass shelf and set the tumbler into the rack and unstoppered the gin bottle and braced his knuckles against the wall in order to pour into the tumbler. But he did not look at the paper. Not even when, shaved, he re-entered the bedroom and went to the bed beside which his slippers sat and shoved the paper aside with his foot in order to step into them. Perhaps, doubtless, he did not need to. The trial was but entering its third tabloidal day now, and so for 2 days his daughter's face had sprung out at him, hard, blonde, and inscrutable, from every paper he opened. Doubtless, he had never forgot her while he slept even. That he had waked into thinking about remembering her, as he had waked into the dying drunken uproar of the evening 8 hours behind him without any interval between for rest or forgetting. Nevertheless, as, dressed in a burnt orange turtleneck sweater beneath his gray flannels, he descended the Spanish staircase. He was outwardly calm and possessed. The delicate iron balustrade and the marble steps coiled down to the tile-floored and barn-like living room, beyond which he could hear his wife and son talking on the breakfast terrace. The son's name was Void. He and his wife had named the two children by what might have been called mutual contemptuous armistice. His wife called the boy Void, for what reason he never knew. He in his turn named the girl, the child whose woman's face had met him from every paper he touched for 2 days now beneath or above the name, April Lalier. Samantha, after his own mother. He could hear them talking, the wife, between whom and himself there had been nothing save civility, and not always a great deal of that for 10 years now, and the son, who one afternoon 2 years ago had been delivered at the door drunk and insensible by a car whose occupants he did not see, and, it devolving upon him to undress the son and put him to bed, whom he discovered to be wearing, in place of underclothes, a woman's brassiere and step-ins. A few minutes later, hearing the blows, perhaps, Void's mother ran in and found her husband beating the still unconscious son with a series of towels which a servant was steeping in rotation in a basin of ice water. He was beating the son hard, with grim and deliberate fury. Whether he was trying to sober the son up or was merely beating him, possibly he himself did not know. His wife, though, jumped to the latter conclusion. In his raging disillusionment, he tried to tell her about the woman's garments, but she refused to listen. She assailed him in turn with virago fury. Since that day, the son had contrived to see his father only in his mother's presence, which neither the son nor the mother found very difficult, by the way, and at which times the son treated his father with a blend of cringing spite and vindictive insolence, half a cat's and half a woman's. He emerged onto the terrace. The voices ceased. The son, strained by the vague, high, soft, almost nebulous California haze, fell upon the terrace with a kind of treacherous unbrightness. The terrace, the sun-drenched terracotta tiles, butted into a rough and savage sheer of canyon wall, bare, yet without dust, on or against which a solid mat of flowers bloomed in fierce, lush, myriad-colored paradox, as though in place of being rooted into and drawing from the soil, they lived upon air alone and had been merely leaned intact against the sustenanceless lava wall by someone who would later return and take them away. The sun, Void, apparently naked save for a pair of straw-colored shorts, his body brown with sun and scented faintly by the depilatory which he used on arms, chest, and legs, lay in a wicker chair, his feet in straw beach shoes, an open newspaper across his brown legs. The paper was the highest class one of the city, yet there was a black headline across half of it, too. And even without pausing, without even being aware that he had looked, Ira saw there, too, the name which he recognized. He went on to his place. The Filipino who put him to bed each night, in a white service jacket now, drew his chair, Beside the glass of orange juice and the waiting cup lay a neat pile of mail topped by a telegram. He sat down and took up the telegram. He had not glanced at his wife until she spoke. "Mrs. Ewing telephoned. She says for you to stop in there on your way to town." He stopped. His hands opening the telegram stopped. Still blinking a little against the sun, he looked at the face opposite him across the table, the smooth, dead makeup, the thin lips, and the thin nostrils, and the pale, blue, unforgiving eyes. The meticulous platinum hair, which looked as though it had been transferred to her skull with a brush from a book of silver leaf, such as window painters use. "What?" he said. "Telephoned? Here?" "Why not? Have I ever objected to any of your women telephoning you here?" The unopened telegram crumpled suddenly in his hand. "You know what I mean," he said harshly. "She never telephoned me in her life. She don't have to. Not that message. When have I ever failed to go by there on my way to town?" "How do I know?" she said. "Or are you the same model son you have been a husband and seemed to be a father?" Her voice was not shrill yet, nor even very loud, and none could have told how fast her breathing was because she sat so still, rigid beneath the impeccable and unbelievable hair, looking at him with that pale and outraged unforgiveness. They both looked at each other across the luxurious table, the two people who at one time 20 years ago would have turned as immediately and naturally and unthinkingly to one another in trouble, who even 10 years ago might have done so. "You know what I mean," he said, harshly again, holding himself too against the trembling which he doubtless believed was from last night's drinking, from the spent alcohol. "She don't read papers. She never even sees one. Did you send it to her?"
"I?" she said. "Send what?"
"Damnation!" he cried. "A paper! Did you send it to her? Don't lie to me."
"What if I did?" she cried. "Who is she that she must not know about it? Who is she that you should shield her from knowing it? Did you make any effort to keep me from knowing it? Did you make any effort to keep it from happening? Why didn't you think about that all those years while you were too drunk, too besotted with drink to know or notice or care what Samantha was—"
"Miss April Lalier of the cinema, if you please," Void said. They paid no attention to him. They glared at one another across the table. "Ah," he said, quiet and rigid, his lips scarcely moving. "So I am to blame for this, too, am I? I made my daughter a bitch, did I? Maybe you will tell me next that I made my son a f—" "Stop!" she cried. She was panting now. They glared at one another across the suave table, across the 5 feet of irrevocable division. "Now, now," Void said. "Don't interfere with the girl's career. After all these years, when at last she seems to have found a part that she can—" He ceased. His father had turned and was looking at him. Void lay in his chair, looking at his father with that veiled insolence that was almost feminine. Suddenly it became completely feminine. With a muffled half-scream, he swung his legs out to spring up and flee, but it was too late. Ira stood above him, gripping him not by the throat, but by the face with one hand, so that Void's mouth puckered and slobbered in his father's hard, shaking hand. Then the mother sprang forward and tried to break Ira's grip, but he flung her away and then caught and held her, struggling too, with the other hand, when she sprang in again.
"Go on," he said. "Say it."
But Void could say nothing because of his father's hand gripping his jaws open, or more than likely because of terror. His body was free of the chair now, writhing and thrashing, while he made his slobbering, moaning sound of terror, while his father held him with one hand and held his screaming mother with the other one. Then Ira flung Void free onto the terrace. Void rolled once and came onto his feet, crouching, retreating toward the French windows with one arm flung up before his face while he cursed his father. Then he was gone. Ira faced his wife, holding her quiet too at last, panting too, the skillful map of makeup standing into relief now like a paper mask trimmed smoothly and pasted onto her skull. He released her.
"You sot," she said. "You drunken sot. And yet you wonder why your children..."
"Yes," he said quietly. "All right. That's not the question. That's all done. The question is what to do about it. My father would have known. He did it once."
He spoke in a dry, light, pleasant voice, so much so that she stood, panting still but quiet, watching him.
"I remember. I was about 10. We had rats in the barn. We tried everything. Terriers, poison. Then one day Father said, 'Come.' We went to the barn and stopped all the cracks, the holes. Then we set fire to it. What do you think of that?"
Then she was gone too.
He stood for a moment, blinking a little, his eyeballs beating faintly and steadily in his skull, with the impact of the soft, unchanging sunlight, the fierce, innocent mass of the flowers.
"Philip," he called.
The Filipino appeared, brown-faced, impassive, with a pot of hot coffee, and set it beside the empty cup and the ice-bedded glass of orange juice.
"Get me a drink," Ira said.
The Filipino glanced at him. Then he became busy at the table, shifting the cup and setting the pot down and shifting the cup again, while Ira watched him.
"Did you hear me?" Ira said.
The Filipino stood erect and looked at him.
"You told me not to give it to you until you had your orange juice and coffee."
"Will you or won't you get me a drink?" Ira shouted.
"Very good, sir,"
the Filipino said. He went out. Ira looked after him. This had happened before. He knew well that the brandy would not appear until he had finished the orange juice and the coffee, though just where the Filipino lurked to watch him, he never knew. He sat again and opened the crumpled telegram and read it, the glass of orange juice in the other hand. It was from his secretary. "Made setup before I broke story last night. Stop. 30% front page. Stop. Made appointment for you courthouse this PM. Stop. Will you come to office or call me?" He read the telegram again, the glass of orange juice still poised. Then he put both down and rose and went and lifted the paper from the terrace where Void had flung it and read the half headline. "Lalier woman, daughter of prominent local family. Admits real name is Samantha Ewing, daughter of Ira Ewing, local realtor." He read it quietly. He said quietly, aloud,
"It was that Jap that showed her the paper. It was that damned gardener."
He returned to the table. After a while, the Filipino came with the brandy and soda, and wearing now a jacket of bright, imitation tweed, telling him that the car was ready. His mother lived in Glendale. It was the house which he had taken when he married and later bought, in which his son and daughter had been born. A bungalow in a cul-de-sac of pepper trees and flowering shrubs and vines, which the Japanese tended, backed into a barren foothill, combed and curried into a cypress and marble cemetery, dramatic as a stage set, and topped by an electric sign in red bulbs which, in the San Fernando Valley fog, glared in broad, sourceless ruby, as though just beyond the crest lay not heaven, but hell. The length of his sports model car in which the Filipino sat reading a paper dwarfed it. But she would have no other, just as she would have neither servant, car, nor telephone. A gaunt, spare, slightly stooped woman, upon whom even California and ease had put no flesh, sitting in one of the chairs which she had insisted on bringing all the way from Nebraska. At first, she had been content to allow the Nebraska furniture to remain in storage, since it had not been needed. When I removed his wife and family out of the house and into the second one, the intermediate one they had bought new furniture to, leaving the first house furnished complete for his mother. But one day, he could not recall just when, he discovered that she had taken the one chair out of storage and was using it in the house. Later, after he began to sense that quality of unrest in her, he had suggested that she let him clear the house of its present furniture and take all of hers out of storage, but she declined, apparently preferring or desiring to leave the Nebraska furniture where it was. Sitting so, a knitted shawl about her shoulders, she looked less like she lived in or belonged to the house, the room, than the son with his beach burn and his faintly theatrical gray temples and his bright, expensive, suavely antiphonal garments did. She had changed hardly at all in the 34 years. She and the older Ira Ewing, too, as the son remembered him, who, dead, had suffered as little of alteration as while he had been alive. As the sod Nebraska outpost had grown into a village and then into a town, his father's aura alone had increased, growing into the proportions of a giant who at some irrevocable yet recent time had engaged barehanded in some titanic struggle with the pitiless earth and endured, and in a sense conquered, it too, like the town, a shadow out of all proportion to the gaunt, gnarled figure of the actual man. And the actual woman, too, as the son remembered them back in that time. Two people who drank air, and who required to eat and sleep, as he did, and who had brought him into the world, yet were strangers, as though of another race, who stood side by side in an irrevocable loneliness, as though strayed from another planet, not as husband and wife, but as blood brother and sister, even twins, of the same travail because they had gained a strange peace through fortitude and the will and strength to endure. "Tell me again what it is," she said. "I'll try to understand." "So it was Kazumura that showed you the damned paper," he said. She didn't answer this. She was not looking at him. "You tell me she has been in the pictures before, for 2 years. That was why she had to change her name. That they all have to change their names." "Yes. They call them extra parts. For about 2 years, God knows why." "And then you tell me that this, that all this was so she could get into the pictures." He started to speak. Then he caught himself back out of some quick impatience, some impatience perhaps of grief or despair, or at least rage, holding his voice, his tone, quiet. "I said that was one possible reason. All I know is that the man has something to do with pictures, giving out the parts, and that the police caught him and Samantha and the other girl in an apartment with the doors all locked, and that Samantha and the other woman were naked. They say that he was naked too, and he says he was not. He says in the trial that he was framed, tricked, that they were trying to blackmail him into giving them parts in a picture, that they fooled him into coming there and arranged for the police to break in just after they had taken off their clothes, that one of them made a signal from the window. Maybe so. Or maybe they were all just having a good time and were innocently caught." Unmoving, rigid, his face broke, wrung with faint, bitter smiling as though with indomitable and impassive suffering, or maybe just smiling, just rage. Still his mother did not look at him.
"But you told me she was already in the pictures, that was why she had to change her—"
I said extra parts, he said. He had to catch himself again, out of his jangled and outraged nerves, back from the fierce fury of the impatience. Can't you understand that you don't get into the pictures just by changing your name, and that you don't even stay there when you get in, that you can't even stay there by being female, that they come here in droves on every train, girls younger and prettier than Samantha, and who will do anything to get into the pictures? So will she, apparently. But who know or are willing to learn to do more things than even she seems to have thought of. But let's don't talk about it. She has made her bid. All I can do is to help her up. I can't wash the sheets. Nobody can. I must go, anyway. I'm late. He rose, looking down at her. They said you telephoned me this morning. Is this what it was? No, she said. Now she looked up at him. Now her gnarled hands began to pick faintly at one another. You offered me a servant once. Yes. I thought 15 years ago that you ought to have one. Have you changed your mind? Do you want me to... Now she stopped looking at him again, though her hands did not cease. That was 15 years ago. It would have cost at least $500 a year. That would be... He laughed, short and harsh. I'd like to see the Los Angeles servant you could get for $500 a year. But what? He stopped, laughing, looking down at her. That would be at least $5,000, she said. He looked down at her. After a while, he said, Are you asking me again for money? She didn't answer nor move, her hands picking slowly and quietly at one another. Ah, he said. You want to go away. You want to run from it. So do I, he cried, before he could catch himself this time. So do I. But you did not choose me when you elected a child. Neither did I choose my two. But I shall have to bear them, and you will have to bear all of us. There is no help for it. He caught himself now, panting, quieting himself by will, as when he would rise from bed, though his voice was still harsh. Where would you go? Where would you hide from it?
Home, she said.
Home? He repeated. He repeated in a kind of amazement. Home? Before he understood. You would go back there with those winters, that snow and all? Why, you wouldn't live to see the first Christmas, don't you know that? She didn't move nor look up at him. Nonsense, he said. This will blow over. In a month there will be two others, and nobody except us will even remember it, and you don't need money. You have been asking me for money for years, but you don't need it. I had to worry about money so much at one time myself that I swore that the least I could do was to arrange your affairs so you would never even have to look at the stuff. I must go. There is something at the office today. I'll see you tomorrow.
It was already 1 o'clock.
Courthouse, he told the Filipino, settling back into the car. My God, I want a drink.
He rode with his eyes closed against the sun. The secretary had already sprung onto the running board before he realized that they had reached the courthouse. The secretary, bareheaded too, wore a jacket of authentic tweed. His turtleneck sweater was dead black. His hair was black too, varnished smooth to his skull. He spread before Ira a dummy newspaper page laid out to embrace the blank space for the photograph beneath the caption, April Lalier's father. Beneath the space was the legend, Ira Ewing, president of the Ewing Realty Company, Wilshire Boulevard, Beverly Hills.
Is 30% all you could get? Ira said. The secretary was young. He glared at Ira for an instant in vague, impatient fury.
Jesus, 30% is 30%. They are going to print 1,000 extra copies and use our mailing list. It will be spread all up and down the coast and as far east as Reno. What do you want?
We can't expect them to put under your picture, turn to page 14 for half-page ad, can we?
Ira sat again with his eyes closed, waiting for his head to stop.
All right, he said. Are they ready now?
All set. You will have to go inside. They insisted it be inside, so everybody that sees it will know it is the courthouse.
All right, Ira said.
He got out, with his eyes half closed, and the secretary at his elbow, he mounted the steps and entered the courthouse. The reporter and the photographer were waiting, but he did not see them yet. He was aware only of being enclosed in a gaping crowd which he knew would be mostly women, hearing the secretary and a policeman clearing the way in the corridor outside the courtroom door. This is okay, the secretary said. Ira stopped. The darkness was easier on his eyes, though he did not open them yet. He just stood, hearing the secretary and the policeman herding the women, the faces, back. Someone took him by the arm and turned him. He stood obediently. The magnesium flashed and glared, striking against his painful eyeballs like blows. He had a vision of wan faces craned to look at him from either side of a narrow human lane. With his eyes shut tight now, he turned, blundering until the reporter in charge spoke to him.
Just a minute, Chief. We better get another one just in case.
This time his eyes were tightly closed. The magnesium flashed, washed over them. In the thin, acrid smell of it, he turned, and with the secretary again at his elbow, he moved blindly back and into the sunlight and into his car. He gave no order this time. He just said,
"Get me a drink."
He rode with his eyes closed again while the car cleared the downtown traffic and then began to move quiet, powerful, and fast under him. He rode so for a long while before he felt the car swing into the palm-bordered drive, slowing. It stopped. The doorman opened the door for him, speaking to him by name. The elevator boy called him by name, too, stopping at the right floor without direction. He followed the corridor and knocked at a door and was fumbling for the key when the door opened upon a woman in a bathing suit beneath a loose beach cloak. A woman with treated hair also and brown eyes, who swung the door back for him to enter and then too, behind him. Looking at him with the quick, bright, faint, serene smiling, which only a woman nearing 40 can give to a man to whom she is not married and from whom she has had no secrets physical and few mental over a long time of pleasant and absolute intimacy. She had been married, though, and divorced. She had a child, a daughter of 14, whom he was now keeping in boarding school. He looked at her, blinking as she closed the door.
"You saw the papers," he said.
She kissed him, not suddenly, without heat, in a continuation of the movement which closed the door with a sort of warm envelopment. Suddenly he cried,
"I can't understand it. After all the advantages that... after all I tried to do for them..."
"Hush," she said. "Hush now. Get into your trunks. I'll have a drink ready for you when you have changed. Will you eat some lunch if I have it sent up?"
"No, I don't want any lunch. After all I have tried to give..."
"Hush now.
Get into your trunks while I fix you a drink. It's going to be swell at the beach."
In the bedroom, his bathing trunks and robe were laid out on the bed. He changed, hanging his suit in the closet where her clothes hung, where there hung already another suit of his and clothes for the evening. When he returned to the sitting room, she had fixed the drink for him. She held the match to his cigarette
and watched him sit down and take up the glass, watching him still with that serene, impersonal smiling. Now he watched her slip off the cape and kneel at the cellaret, filling a silver flask. In the bathing costume of the moment, such as 10,000 wax female dummies wore in 10,000 shop windows that summer, such as 100,000 young girls wore on California beaches. He looked at her, kneeling, back, buttocks, and flanks trim enough, even firm enough, so firm, in fact, as to be a little on the muscular side, what with unremitting and perhaps even rigorous care, but still those of 40. But I don't want a young girl, he thought. Would to God that all young girls, all young female flesh, were removed, blasted even, from the earth. He finished the drink before she had filled the flask. I want another one, he said. All right, she said. As soon as we get to the beach. No, now. Let's go to the beach first. It's almost 3 o'clock. Won't that be better? Just so you are not trying to tell me I can't have another drink now. Of course not, she said, slipping the flask into the cape's pocket and looking at him again with that warm, faint, inscrutable smiling. I just want to have a dip before the water gets too cold. They went down to the car. The Filipino knew this too. He held the door for her to slip under the wheel, then he got himself into the back. The car moved on. She drove well. Why not lean back and shut your eyes, she told Ira, and rest until we get to the beach. Then we will have a dip and a drink. I don't want to rest, he said. I'm all right. But he did close his eyes again, and again the car ran powerful, smooth, and fast beneath him, performing its afternoon's jaunt over the incredible distances of which the city was composed. From time to time, had he looked, he could have seen the city in the bright, soft, vague, hazy sunlight, random, scattered about the arid earth like so many gay scraps of paper blown without order, with its curious air of being rootless, of houses bright, beautiful, and gay, without basements or foundations, lightly attached to a few inches of light, penetrable earth, lighter even than dust, and laid lightly in turn upon the profound and primeval lava which one good hard rain would wash forever from the sight and memory of man as a fire hose flushes down a gutter. That city of almost incalculable wealth, whose queerly appropriate fate it is to be erected upon a few spools of a substance whose value is computed in billions, and which may be completely destroyed in that second's instant of a careless match between the moment of striking and the moment when the striker might have sprung and stamped it out. You saw your mother today, she said. Has she? Yes. He didn't open his eyes. That damned Jap gave it to her. She asked me for money again. I found out what she wants with it. She wants to run, to go back to Nebraska. I told her, so did I. If she went back there, she would not live until Christmas. The first month of winter would kill her. Maybe it wouldn't even take winter to do it. She still drove. She still watched the road. Yet somehow, she had contrived to become completely immobile. So that's what it is, she said. He did not open his eyes. What is? The reason she has been after you all this time to give her money, cash. Why, even when you won't do it, every now and then she asks you again. What? He opened his eyes. Looking at her profile, he sat up suddenly. You mean she's been wanting to go back there all the time? That all these years she has been asking me for money, that was what she wanted with it? She glanced at him swiftly, then back to the road. What else can it be? What else could she use money for? Back there, he said, To those winters, that town, that way of living? Where she's bound to know that the first winter would... You'd almost think she wanted to die, wouldn't you?
Hush, she said quickly. Shh, don't say that. Don't say that about anybody.
Already they could smell the sea. Now they swung down toward it. The bright salt wind blew upon them. With the long-spaced sound of the rollers, now they could see it. The dark blue of water creaming into the blanched curve of beach dotted with bathers.
We won't go through the club, she said. I'll park in here and we can go straight to the water.
They left the Filipino in the car and descended to the beach. It was already crowded, bright and gay with movement. She chose a vacant space and spread her cape. Now that drink, he said.
Have your dip first, she said.
He looked at her. Then he slipped his robe off slowly. She took it and spread it beside her own. He looked down at her. Which is it? Will you always be too clever for me? Or is it that every time I will always believe you again? She looked at him, bright, warm, fond, and inscrutable.
Maybe both.
Maybe neither.
Have your dip. I will have the flask and a cigarette ready when you come out.
When he came back from the water, wet, panting, his heart a little too hard and fast, she had the towel ready, and she lit the cigarette and uncapped the flask as he lay on the spread robes. She lay, too, lifted to one elbow, smiling down at him, smoothing the water from his hair with the towel while he panted, waiting for his heart to slow and quiet. Steadily between them and the water, and as far up and down the beach as they could see, the bathers passed, young people, young men in trunks, and young girls in little more, with bronzed, unself-conscious bodies. Lying so, they seemed to him to walk along the rim of the world as though they and their kind alone inhabited it. And he, with his 48 years, were the forgotten last survivor of another race and kind. And they, in turn, precursors of a new race not yet seen on the earth, of men and women without age, beautiful as gods and goddesses, and with the minds of infants. He turned quickly and looked at the woman beside him, at the quiet face, the wise, smiling eyes, the grained skin and temples, the hair roots showing where the dye had grown out, the legs veined faint and blue and myriad beneath the skin.
You look better than any of them, he cried. You look better to me than any of them.
The Japanese gardener, with his hat on, stood tapping on the glass and beckoning and grimacing until old Mrs. Ewing went out to him. He had the afternoon's paper with its black headline, Lalier Woman Creates Scene in Courtroom.
You take, the Japanese said. Read while I catch water.
But she declined. She just stood in the soft, halcyon sunlight, surrounded by the myriad and almost fierce blooming of flowers, and looked quietly at the headline without even taking the paper, and that was all.
I guess I won't look at the paper today, she said. Thank you just the same.
She returned to the living room. Save for the chair, it was exactly as it had been when she first saw it, that day when her son brought her into it and told her that it was now her home and that her daughter-in-law and her grandchildren were now her family. It had changed very little, and that which had altered was the part which her son knew nothing about, and that, too, had changed not at all in so long that she could not even remember now when she had added the last coin to the hoard. This was in a china vase on the mantel. She knew what was in it to the penny. Nevertheless, she took it down and sat in the chair which she had brought all the way from Nebraska and emptied the coins and the worn timetable into her lap. The timetable was folded back at the page on which she had folded it the day she walked downtown to the ticket office and got it 15 years ago. Though that was so long ago now that the penciled circle about the name of the nearest junction point to Ewing, Nebraska, had faded away. But she did not need that either. She knew the distance to the exact half mile, just as she knew the fare to the penny and back in the early 20s when the railroads began to become worried and passenger fares began to drop. No broker ever watched the grain and utilities market any closer than she watched the railroad advertisements and quotations. Then, at last, the fares became stabilized, with the fare back to Ewing $13 more than she had been able to save, and at a time when her source of income had ceased. This was the two grandchildren. When she entered the house that day 20 years ago and looked at the two babies for the first time, it was with diffidence and eagerness, both. She would be dependent for the rest of her life, but she would give something in return for it. It was not that she would attempt to make another Ira and Samantha Ewing of them. She had made that mistake with her own son and had driven him from home. She was wiser now. She saw now that it was not the repetition of hardship. She would merely take what had been of value in hers and her husband's hard lives. That which they had learned through hardship and endurance of honor and courage and pride, and transmit it to the children without their having to suffer the hardship at all, the travail and the despairs. She had expected that there would be some friction between her and the young daughter-in-law, but she had believed that her son, the actual Ewing, would be her ally. She had even reconciled herself after a year to waiting, since the children were still but babies. She was not alarmed, since they were Ewings too. After she had looked that first, searching time at the two putty-soft little faces, feature by feature, she had said it was because they were babies yet, and so looked like no one. So she was content to bide and wait. She did not even know that her son was planning to move until he told her that the other house was bought and that the present one was to be hers until she died. She watched them go. She said nothing. It was not to begin then. It did not begin for 5 years, during which she watched her son making money faster and faster and easier, gaining with apparent contemptible and contemptuous ease that substance for which in niggard amounts her husband had striven while still clinging with undeviating incorruptibility to honor and dignity and pride, and spending it, squandering it in the same way. By that time she had given up the son, and she had long since learned that she and her daughter-in-law were irrevocable and implacable moral enemies. It was in the 5th year. One day in her son's home, she saw the two children take money from their mother's purse lying on a table. The mother did not even know how much she had in the purse. When the grandmother told her about it, she became angry and dared the older woman to put it to the test. The grandmother accused the children, who denied the whole affair with perfectly straight faces. That was the actual break between herself and her son's family. After that, she saw the two children only when the son would bring them with him occasionally on his unfailing daily visits. She had a few broken dollars which she had brought from Nebraska and had kept intact for 5 years, since she had no need for money here. One day, she planted one of the coins while the children were there, and when she went back to look, it was gone too. The next morning, she tried to talk to her son about the children, remembering her experience with the daughter-in-law and approaching the matter indirectly, speaking generally of money. "Yes," the son said, "I'm making money. I'm making it fast while I can. I'm going to make a lot of it. I'm going to give my children luxuries and advantages that my father never dreamed a child might have." "That's it," she said. "You make money too easy.
This whole country is too easy for us Ewings. It may be all right for them that have been born here for generations. I don't know about that. But not for us.
But these children were born here.
Just one generation. The generation before that, they were born in a sod-roofed dugout on the Nebraska wheat frontier. And the one before that, in a log house in Missouri. And the one before that, in a Kentucky blockhouse with Indians around it. This world has never been easy for Ewings. Maybe the Lord never intended it to be.
But it is from now on, he said. He spoke with a kind of triumph. For you and me too, but mostly for them. And that was all. When he was gone, she sat quietly in the single Nebraska chair which she had taken out of storage, the first chair which the older Ira Ewing had bought for her after he built a house and in which she had rocked the younger Ira to sleep before he could walk, while the older Ira himself sat in the chair which he had made out of a flour barrel, grim, quiet, and incorruptible, taking his earned twilight ease between a day and a day, telling herself quietly that that was all. Her next move was curiously direct. There was something in it of the actual pioneer's opportunism, of taking immediate and cold advantage of Spartan circumstance. It was as though, for the first time in her life, she was able to use something, anything, which she had gained by bartering her youth and strong maturity against the Nebraska immensity. And this, not in order to live further, but in order to die. Apparently, she saw neither paradox in it nor dishonesty. She began to make candy and cake of the materials which her son bought for her on credit, and to sell them to the two grandchildren for the coins which their father gave them, or which they perhaps purloined also from their mother's purse. Hiding the coins in the vase, with the timetable, watching the niggard hoard grow. But after a few years, the children outgrew candy and cake, and then she had watched railroad fares go down, and then stop, $13 away. But she did not give up, even then. Her son had tried to give her a servant years ago, and she had refused. She believed that when the time came, the right moment, he would not refuse to give her at least $13 of the money which she had saved him. Then this had failed.
Maybe it wasn't the right time, she thought. Maybe I tried it too quick. I was surprised into it, she told herself, looking down at the heap of small coins in her lap. Or maybe he was surprised into saying no. Maybe when he has had time...
She roused. She put the coins back into the vase and set it on the mantel again, looking at the clock as she did so. It was just 4, 2 hours yet until time to start supper. The sun was high. She could see the water from the sprinkler flashing and glinting in it as she went to the window. It was still high, still afternoon. The mountains stood serene and drab against it. The city, the land, lay sprawled and myriad beneath it. The land, the earth which spawned 1,000 new faiths, nostrums and cures each year, but no disease to even disprove them on, beneath the golden days unmarred by rain or weather, the changeless, monotonous, beautiful days without end, countless, out of the halcyon past, and endless into the halcyon future.
I will stay here and live forever, she said to herself.